Listen, we have breaking, hot off the press, penis sucking news.
This is the Extra Hot Grape Podcast, episode 310 for the week of July 6, 2020. I am threatening butterknife David T. Cole, and I'm here with Random Henry Sarah D. Bunting.
A lot of swords in those.
And Kook Princess Tara Ariano.
Let's take our yacht out to the marsh.
Hello, everybody, and welcome to a special episode of Extra Hot Great. This is our all foreskinning episode, and even within the confines of the special foreskinning episodes, this is a little bit specialer because this is the first time we had our guests in turn tell us what to watch. So I'll just start it off, shall I?
Sure.
Sure.
All right, I will. Stephanie forced me originally to watch an episode of Real Housewives of Auckland, and Auckland's from a country called New Zealand, which is like somewhere in the ocean, and it was available. And then when it came time to watch it a couple days ago, it was not. So quick audible, we're now doing the Real Housewives of Potomac, and this episode is
season 4, episode 8, Sex, Lies, and Butter Knives. And this was also chosen by her. We texted her the night that we were going to watch it, and she chose this instead. So this is still her forcing
a slight lateral
move. We did not
move.
Choose this at random. Yes. She came back to us
a
with
slow
this
boat
instead.
From New Zealand to Washington.
Exactly.
thank you for the information. So Real Housewives,
Dave's favorite.
Look, I know this is the foreskinning, and I don't want to bring us down, but this is a type of show that I genuinely dislike and find it very hard to extract joy from. There was the one canon entry where I actually did vote an episode of this franchise in just because I could see what they were doing. And for people that enjoy this, brackets, not me, I understood that that was a sort of a tour de force of diva culture and eavesdropping on people's problems and all the kind of stuff that I think that people that enjoy Real Housewives go in it for.
Mm-hmm. Didn't you vote 2 in? I thought you voted Kevin's in as well.
I don't think so. I think I just voted 1 in.
Okay.
And the other one got in.
Okay.
So this is apparently one that I've never even heard of.
Yeah. It's one of the newer ones. Okay. I mean, obviously, season 4, this is the most recent season. Season 5 is about to premiere in August.
Shaking my head. All right. So 6 ladies somewhere in the Washington, D.C. area. You know, same story. They all got money. They got too much time. They don't have enough to do. And they, for the camera mostly, just gin up all these dumb arguments. And then there's always a dinner party. And at the dinner party, there's tables flipped or knives thrown or something like that. And this episode is no different. I think why this episode is probably the one that got put up was because there's a drunk husband who might be gay. And everybody thinks either said drunkenly at a party recently, as of the taping of this show, I want to suck a sausage or I want to suck somebody's dick.
Yeah. And not just someone's dick, but one of the other husbands.
Correct.
Yeah.
So let me run down who's on this show for the uninitiated. We have Giselle, who I'm going to shorthand as Vanessa Williams.
Yeah, she does look like Vanessa Williams. She's very pretty.
Karen, who is older of the group, I think, probably the oldest of the group. Mm-hmm. We have Monique, who's 7 months pregnant.
Right.
We have Robin with short hair, and her tagline is, the shorter the hair, the shorter my patience. What?
I assume she got a haircut or between seasons, and that's why she changed
some
her tagline.
Sort of terrible Samson or something? Like, reverse Samson? Oh, no. We have Ashley, who is a singer, with a Aussie husband, who is the husband in question.
Right.
Who really enjoys pool tables, and was sad to see his pool table go in this episode. His name is Michael.
Oh. Yep.
Mm-hmm. And we have Candace, whose husband is a barbecue guy.
He's working on a cookbook.
Yeah. And she is at the center of some beef with a whole bunch of people, some on the show and then some not on the show.
She's it's a real shitster.
Yeah.
She's at the center of like every beef that comes up in this episode, including the barbecue beef, because her husband is the one that cooks at the dinner party. Ha ha ha.
Beef.
I see. Barbecue beef.
Thank you.
That's pretty good.
Yeah, she refers to a fight that she had with her mother in like a maybe in a previous episode, or it happened off screen, unclear, where like they got into it and her mother hit her in the face with her purse, which like rough.
At a wedding.
In front of a wedding. Yeah, because she lives in her mother's house. Right. She and her husband live in a house that her mother owns. And so that's another point of like conflict for them, because she really obviously wants to move out of her mother's house for reasons that seem clear. Given the purse smacking.
Sure. That's as the saying goes, don't live in the house of a person that smacks you in the face with a purse.
Seems obvious.
I'm going to stitch that on a pillow.
Okay. So that is our cast. I will say I sort of lose track of sort of, you know, those types of charts where they, you know, they basically draw strings in between people with all the relationships, you know.
FBI mafia crazy wall. Yes.
This person hates this person currently, but not this person, but they used to, and all this sort of stuff. So yes, it's sort of like, you know, your typical red string wall of crazy, except it is crazy. So what happens in the episode? First, we find out that, yes, Candace was slapped in the face with a purse by her mother. And then we switch over to Ashley, who is the singer with the possible dick-sucking Aussie husband. She has just let the audience know that she was pinged by the local Pride Parade committee or something to sing her song,
Coffee and Love.
So I had to track it down. And this whole song is warbled auto-tune. I thought the whole point of auto-tune was to mask the fact that you actually can't hit your notes. You can tell through the auto-tune how bad she is at singing. Here's just like literally 10 seconds of the song. And the song, I'm going like this. Here we go.
Ooh.
Yeah. So I was looking at the YouTube comments for this. My favorite one was, I saw on Real Housewives that you were going to sing this at Pride. I'm going to skip Pride this year.
Ouch.
Yeah. And the video is like super generic. Like she's in a pool. She's blowing feathers in the camera. You know, it has a, I don't know what you call it, the rapping break, you know, in the song.
Sure.
By some rapper. I'm sure she paid way too much money to, because she needed something
to,
you know, in the
to
song.
Break it up.
And this person's like, that's an easy 10K for me or whatever.
Sure.
It was. So it's one of those songs. It is completely and absolutely generic. It is the Shutterstock video of videos. So that's Ashley. Candace says Ashley is a phony because prior to this episode, there was some sort of share your miscarriage story roundabout at Monique's party, I believe, who's currently pregnant.
Right. Ashley previously had a miscarriage.
Yes. And Candace thinks Ashley and her husband are either like lying or playing it up or not sincere or something. Something was off about them, according to Candace. They weren't genuine.
Because they're supposedly they're trying to get pregnant again. That's why he's getting rid of the pool table.
Right. Okay. And then Karen is not really an element too much in this episode. She is taking dancing lessons with her husband, Ray. And Ray, very much like me, does not want to be there or have anything to do with dancing. So just one person in this episode that I can identify with is old man Ray.
Yeah. Karen really seems like she's staying out of the fray, and I admire that.
She is so much, and put a pin in it, but right at the end, when everybody's actually, it gumps to loggerhead, she's basically like talking to the food while everybody is fighting just to like try to keep out of it.
Yeah.
Monique is doing an underwater maternity photo shoot because you have to one up everybody else, I guess. Like, first of all, why are you having a maternity photo shoot? But whatever, I guess people do that. But also underwater.
Also in a what appears to be a wedding gown. Like, it's a lot going on.
A lot going on. And it wasn't just like a quick shoot. And, you know, they like dressed the actual pool underwater with like a photographic backdrop, so it wouldn't just be like your blue tiles or whatever. Mm-hmm. Like, the photos were good.
They were.
Why?
Yeah.
Why are we doing this?
Mm-hmm.
So Giselle, who is our Vanessa Williams lookalike, is a home flipper, I guess. That's what she's trying to get into. And so we watch her go to one house, which is weird. The house looks totally generic from the front, but in the back, it's got like a big caboose. Like, it's weird. It's one of those houses that looks like just like a little bungalow. And then in the back, there's like 20,000 rooms. And
yeah, it's also on a huge acreage. So that's where the value comes from. Yeah.
And the whole thing was just seems to be a scene where Giselle is trying to get love from her mother. And
right.
Grade B, I'm also good. Tell me I'm a good daughter.
So, sure.
Something going on there. Then we have a scene with Ozzy Michael, possible dick sucker husband, at his home with his wife, who is
Ashley the singer.
Yeah, sorry. Yeah. A lot of names here.
Yep.
And Ashley has determined that his purple felt pool table must go in anticipation of a family to come in the future. And they don't need to build a family in the future because this guy's pool table is his family. He is very sad to see this pool table go.
Oh, God.
They rip the felt off in front of him, which seems unnecessary. Like, why would that need to happen in the condo?
To disassemble it, because all the apparatus underneath it is like their slate or a metal slab and stuff like that. I assume that they sold it, and this is like
of course.
The Billage Company came and is going to refurbish it and sell it or something like that.
I didn't know that.
Took it to a farm upstate.
You're free now. Anyways, yeah, you could tell the purple on the playing field was much lighter than the purple around the cushion. Mm-hmm. So it had been there for a while. The felt was worn anyway.
Well, it was right by the window, too. I'm sure it was like just sun faded.
But just because things are old, we don't throw them away. This guy obviously loved his pool table. This is the worst moment of my life, he says, as they start disassembling his pool table.
Just a reminder, we've heard in a previous scene,
they had a miscarriage
supposedly. supposedly in question marks. Candace doubts it.
Yeah, this is a miscarriage of justice, seeing this pool table disassembled. I suppose.
Sure.
The other thing he says is, without this pool table, what are we going to do? Just sit around and get boring and be boring like Karen and her husband who's going dancing? It's like, all right. So apparently playing billiards is the key to everlasting youth, according to Michael. Anyways, without his pool table, who is Michael? Asks Michael.
Mm-hmm.
Who's to say? The next scene is Candace, the shitster, and Monique, the pregnant lady, having a trying-to-clear-the-air brunch, in which they try to clear the air about some sort of name-calling that happened either off-camera or an old episode. They sort of, like, slightly tell different stories about it through other people. You know, they're always using intermediaries to sort of soften what they actually want to say to the people.
Well, I think it must have been off-camera or they would have shown a clip.
That's probably true. So the gist of it is, and I'm not even going to try to figure out, is somebody who's actually not on the show named Katie.
Mm-hmm. Although she shows up at the dinner. So I think she's not a main cast member. She's like a friend.
Right. Somebody called her Amistad.
Yeah.
Because she
had a headscarf on or
something. Had a headscarf on, yeah.
We're not going to get into this. This is not for us. To get into, it's very ugly. Whatever happened, it was not
people
okay.
were not happy with it, but also people were also playing it up, obviously. Like,
yes.
This was grist for the mill, right? Like,
absolutely.
It was problematic, it was a problem, but more importantly, it's something to complain about.
Yes.
Especially for Candace, who is chief complainer amongst these six women.
Yes.
So that lunch happens, and it concludes without a real meeting of the minds. There's still animosity there. And then we get to the main event, which is the party at the end of the episode thrown by barbecue wife,
Candace,
and her husband, Chris,
okay,
who owns a barbecue shop or something, maybe, but he's authoring a barbecue book, and they think this book is what is going to make them enough money to be able to buy something of their own and get out from under her mother's foot.
Right. I think the premise of this dinner party is he's trying out recipes on them.
And he wants feedback
for the cook
from these women who can do nothing but provide honest feedback 24/7.
I mean, you could do worse.
You could do worse.
I believe that they would tell him the truth.
Hey, if you have a tool, use it.
Yep.
You know, that's great. Have at it.
Mm-hmm.
So the party. The main event is Michael got drunk. And he said he wanted to suck a sausage or suck a dick. And there's a big discussion about that, whether he actually said sausage or dick. And then somebody remembers that a year before the most recent episode, there was a party in which he got drunk and grabbed one of the husband's butts.
Right. And Candace recaps this before Ashley gets there.
Yes. And this is one of the ways she recaps it.
Michael was on the dance floor where he decided to grab Andrew's butt. Crocodile Dundee had four drinks too many.
Pretty good. So all this is happening while Chris is serving up dinner, appetizers. The weird thing about the production of this episode is that everybody who comes into the camera, if they're the main cast, they get the big glamour introduction with the 3D beveled lettering and the fake Doric column entrance or whatever they're at. But then for some reason, all the food items get their own chyron. Like, it comes in, it's like purple potato skins. Shoo, purple potato skins.
They look good.
Duck quesadilla. Shoo, duck quesadilla. This is a weird
not
choice.
Not the duck quesadilla, but
no, nobody wants duck quesadilla.
No.
Yeah, why do the apps get chyrons? I don't know. It was kind of amazing. Are they characters? Like, why not give them the full 3D gold embossed lettering treatment with the fake columns in the background and all that
stuff? Put
them
in a strapless gown.
Yes.
Give them a little line to say.
Exactly. Like, okay, now we just made this episode a winner, guys. Are you listening, Bravo?
I'll case a DU.
Wah.
So Candace and Ashley get into it at the party. You can't. Ashley's the one that accused Candace of... No, Candace is the one that accused Ashley of being a fakey Fakerson, with her husband being a fakey Fakerson, about the miscarriage and probably everything else in her life.
Yes, including his sexuality.
There's a lot of like garbage thrown into this argument. Ashley knows that Candace's mother is a sore point. So as the volume of this argument comes up, that enters into it. And then Candace absolutely flips out, grabs a butter knife, and starts swinging it around. Like,
just not that threatening. It's a butter knife.
It's a butter knife. But she's wielding it in a way that, sure, she could go in for the stab, but she's absentmindedly waving it away as she argues enough that you could see it actually just popping somebody's eye out.
True.
Her husband kind of comes in there and tries to...
He does.
...tear the situation into safety.
But at the same time, she's also holding it in a way that she's... it's almost like she's holding it like a microphone, too.
Yeah.
like she's Phil Donahue.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. It was a lot. So that just boils over. They yell. Chris, the husband, eventually grabs her, sort of drags her into the kitchen. She throws a knife at Ashley. Ashley freaks out, and that's the end of the episode.
Yeah.
So... classic rich women yelling at each other, throwing stuff, no water thrown in the face, which I guess is the classic move for this, but it was a butter knife instead. Didn't hit them, landed on the floor near them.
Yeah.
But, you know, the Michael thing isn't really talked about anymore. Everybody disagrees that it did happen. It wasn't a drunken dream that they were having. Then the episode ends. If you're into that, I think this episode is something that you would enjoy. I just really can't get into it on any level myself. Like, I was paying attention to things like, why are all these very well-off lower upper middle class or middle upper lower, like, I don't where they don't seem to be like super rich, but they're definitely
well off.
They're very comfortable. All their homes are very unappointed, or like when you stage a home and you just rent the furniture from wherever for a week while people come in and look at it because you moved all your stuff out, it looked like those kind of homes. Like, what is it about rich people and either underdressing their house or extremely overdressing their house?
I mean, if I may, here's a theory. One is that Candace's house, if it's a rental that her mother is just letting her stay in, maybe it isn't dressed with her own stuff because they don't have any.
Well, yeah, that house was definitely in transition.
But in addition to that, if you know that there's going to be crews walking through, if there was anything valuable that you didn't want, like a camera operator to accidentally like back into, you would probably put that away while you're shooting.
I suppose. But even just the walls look kind of unadorned and boring, and everything was white, like nobody had any paint color. For how busy they are in their lives and how much appearance is important to them, I just figured their homes would be better.
Yeah. Yeah, sometimes people just like go to the store and they're like, yeah, I'll buy this setup, what you have right here, I'll take this.
Yeah.
You know, like they don't, some people don't choose things.
Yeah.
With a lot of thought, you know.
So I will conclude in saying that I totally understand why Stephanie put this episode up. I think she knew this wasn't my favorite, but it wasn't like a terrible grading watch. You know what I mean? Like, I'm sure there's episodes, like, I've definitely seen screechier episodes of this franchise, which are more annoying. And the hook of this one is obviously the mystery of the husband.
Right.
And it's a shame they didn't really have follow through for that in this episode, because it was very interesting when it got brought up. Obviously, you want to know the conclusion of the sausage sucker, but you don't get it. So you kind of got blue balls in that regards.
Yeah, it does say to be continued at the end, but we did not continue watching.
Sure.
Yeah.
So that is Real Housewives of the Potomac. Not my bag, but I watched it and I reported it. And my last thought is everybody on this show, the women, their husbands, the realtor, they all have the worst poker faces I've ever seen.
That's true.
Like, some of it might be them being bad liars. A little bit has to be them being bad in front of the camera. But boy. All right. That is mine. All done, packed away. Sarah D. Bunting, you're up. What was your forcening?
My forcening was a show that I had heard of, but wasn't. I think it had just fallen out of my brain because I figured it was aggressively not for me. It is called Upstart Crow. I watched season 3, episode 2, Wild Laughter in the Throat of Death. Speaking of sucking on a sausage, Dan Casino selected this for me. I think I get it. It's basically What If Shakespeare, but a sitcom. And, Will Shakespeare is played by David Mitchell of That Mitchell and Webb Look. I was not encouraged in the first few minutes. My notes read, quote, ugh, this is the kind of theater major shit I can't stand. Cut to name redacted, looking bug-eyed during my high school production of Mother Courage. but it improves. Like, this show, I think, was like contracted by BBC Two as part of the commemorations of the 400th anniversary of the death of William Shakespeare, according to Wikipedia. And the premise is as simple as What If Shakespeare, but a sitcom. The plot of this particular episode, there's a B plot which involves Shakespeare's rival, like, scheming to kill someone else and then steal Shakespeare's good reputation and create ambiguity as to who wrote Shakespeare's plays. But then in the main plot, Shakespeare, the queen loved his last play so much that she wants another comedy immediately, and everyone around him, his family, his friends, one of his fellow writers who's like hiding out with him.
Yeah, it's Marlowe. It's Christopher Marlowe.
So, all right, that and then he's actually, like, they're trying to fake his death and then he's actually killed, which is a sort of funny bit. It turns out that, like, he has already written Hamlet and he is very excited to have people read it and be in awe of his legendary tragedy skills. But then everyone around him thinks it's a comedy. And at first that's like, okay, haha. But then it just keeps going. And this runner about the plot of Hamlet, which bad English major, no biscuit. I've never read it. I don't know how I got here, but I did. I've read King Lear a million times. Hamlet, no, but for whatever reason, that description was all the more hilarious to me. He's like, and then this happens and he's, you know, married to his mother. And then like everyone is cracking up and he's like, it's not funny. It's a tragedy. So then he's trying to actually write a comedy and, I believe his daughter, Susanna, is like, well, what if this, but then that, and he's like, well, oh, okay, well, interesting. What would I write next if I were continuing to write this? And so it's paralleling the ambiguity about his authorship of various things. And there are a number of asides where he's sort of looking partly at the camera while he's talking about, this is exactly the kind of thing that school children will be forced to debate while reciting my works in their classes, something they're sure to enjoy for generations. And it's very knowing and meta. But in a way that I'm on the fence because there's a laugh track, which I don't usually care for. But I'm wondering if that's supposed to underline the anachronistic nature of a lot of this. I did pull a clip, and I think based on this clip, listeners will be able to decide if this is something that is for them. Dave, can you play that, please?
And look at all these sweet London souvenirs. A little severed head of a traitor on a keychain. A little incinerated Catholic martyr on a keychain. A little rotting plague corpse on a keychain. A little country maid who had journeyed here in search of honest work, but within 6 weeks has become a toothless, pox-ridden prostitute on a keychain.
Yeah, thanks very much, Kate. I think we get the gist.
I mean, yeah, I think we do get the gist. The laugh track, like, I think it does underline certain things effectively, but it's also annoying. And maybe that's the point of it. And maybe the fact that he is struggling with what is perceived as comedy is something that the laugh track is kind of hanging a little bit of a light on, because the laugh track is prompting you on certain things. But
I was thinking, when you're saying about comfortable rhythms, I mean, you probably don't haven't watched Blackadder, which this guy was involved in, but the laugh
the creator
track
was.
Yes.
Yeah.
The laugh track was in Blackadder. The rhythms of this are very familiar if you've watched Blackadder. Supposed to be evocative of that. Like, somewhere the pitch was Blackadder-esque, but Shakespeare was also one of the things, and probably the laugh track is in Blackadder too, and I feel like it was just like, look how similar, remember that, you love that.
Yeah, could be. And a lot of it is really, you know, I sort of went back and forth. Like, there's one exchange about super savoricious train tickets that seems to go on as long as a train journey, and the rumpy Pumpington joke is not nearly as funny as anyone in front of the screen thinks it is. But on the other hand, there's a rapid fire thing about, like, comparing pie fillings to like, I'm the steak and pie. And then the other people in the room are like, wait, are we doing sweet fillings with this? And it's very quick and funny. And I played it again because I just enjoyed the way the business was conducted. So this was interesting. I would love to hear Dan Cassino's rationale, because this is both, like, I enjoyed it, but I'm also all set. Like, I feel like this is the most upstart crow-ish of upstart crow, probably, and that this was less exhausting and actively more funny than I expected does not mean that it's quite for me. A couple of things could have been cut. The long back and forth about the words and phrases that Shakespeare will get credit for having invented is witty, but like, one of those jokes is plenty. But yeah, it's an interesting thought experiment that I think succeeded on the part of the creators, but it just is, you know, I'm a little too trashy to really appreciate it, probably. So
I don't know. It seemed to me, we watched it too, and it seemed to me to be like a rusty Blackadder.
Yeah, we watched the premiere like long, long, long ago, probably closer around the time that it came out, and, yeah, and we just watched the one and we're like, that's plenty.
Yeah, like, probably pick, like, you could go down the list of what play is he dealing with in this episode and be like, well, I think this will be the funniest one, and this is the play I know the most about. Like, I might see if there's a King Lear based episode and watch that, but it's also like, you know, you pretty much know what they're going to be doing in the rest of them, and I don't think you need to watch them all unless you're like a Mitchell super fan or a Shakespeare scholar, or yeah. But I mean, this was fine. It was finer than I thought it would be, but it's not so fine that I need to watch the rest.
Did you recognize the guy who played Marla?
I mean, yes, and then I meant to look him up and did not. Who was that?
He is the non-Clem Fandango booth operator from Toast of London. The guy who goes clubbing, disappears for a couple episodes.
She hasn't watched all of it. He's the guy with the mustache.
Yeah.
The other guy in the booth. Yeah, I feel like the person that this is for is like a British person who has a country house and does crosswords and is like every single Shakespeare joke, they're like, like that's as much as they laugh at it. Like it's the poignant grunt show. And it's
yes.
like, you know, and great. Like they deserve to have a show too, but that's not me. Like I want a dumb show like Toast London.
Totally. This is for the Columbia professors who arrived at Lincoln Cinemas late.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But, you know, like Blackadder could have fallen into that trap, too. I feel like the writing just isn't as sharp or quick or mean-spirited as Blackadder. So it is harder to set your mind to enjoying it.
Well, here's the difference, though, if I may. Yeah. I think the difference is that Blackadder, even series two, Blackadder the second, which was also set in the Renaissance, like each episode was about a different thing.
Yeah.
So they could have had, if they had done a Shakespeare episode, it would have been like this. And then the next episode would have been about like the Inquisition or about like, you know, whatever, right. like, or the, you know, plague or starvation or whatever, like the way that that Blackadder actually was. Whereas this is like, okay, you did a ton of research. Great.
Yeah.
Like, I don't need to. I'm impressed. That's great for you. I don't need to see it all.
Yeah, you're right.
That's all.
Yeah. They would have to like make Will Shakespeare more of a Renaissance man with many more interests and things to do besides write plays, right?
Yeah, that's why Blackadder is better. Because it can be more of a survey.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. I will say, whichever prop person created those keychains that we heard referenced deserves some sort of award, because that was really like a lot of care was taken, particularly with the crispy Catholic martyr. I enjoyed that there was utter commitment to that part of the production. So, yeah, over to you, Tara.
Before we get into that, I have one clip I forgot to play for my entry.
Oh.
I was going to play it sight unseen because it is a philosophy about party timing, and I thought it would just be interesting to hear people think is the proper time to get to a party.
But at this point, I feel like when people give you a arrival time, it's rude to arrive at that time. Okay? You need to arrive at least 30 minutes after that time. That's the rule. If you arrive on time, you're disrespecting me.
I agree.
Really?
Huh. Yeah.
Okay. That's a slippery slope.
Well, I mean, it depends on the kind of a party, but like...
I mean, there's fashionably late and there's being insulted that they came on time that you said.
I mean, 30 minutes is maybe pushing it, but if you say seven and someone is, they are on the dot of seven, like, take it easy.
All right.
As a chronically prompt person who has many times walked around a block a couple of times so that I would be there at... like 8:06.
Uh-huh.
I get it.
Okay.
Now it's my turn.
Yes. All right.
Richard Lawson assigned me to watch season one, episode one, pilot, as it is called, of the Netflix original drama Outer Banks. So I had heard of this show. As I said, when he assigned this to me, I was probably not planning to watch it. I vaguely knew it was a teen show and it was set in North Carolina because I knew what the Outer Banks were. That was all I knew. So here we go. Our narrator is named John B. That's what he's called. Lives in the Outer Banks, North Carolina, hangs out with his friends. Their mission this summer is to have a good time all the time. What's the Outer Banks? Let's hear clip one.
The Outer Banks, paradise on earth. It's the sort of place where you either have two jobs or two houses, two tribes, one island. All right, so this is figure eight, the rich side of the island, home of the kooks. So guess where we don't live?
Yeah,
And then this is the South Side, or The Cut. Home of the working class who make a living bussing tables, washing yachts, running charters. The natural habitat of, drumroll please, the Pogues. That's us. Pogues, Pogies, the throwaway fish, lowest member of the food chain. Okay, so the downside of Pogue life is we're ignored and neglected. But the upside of Pogue life, we're ignored and neglected. Which means we do whatever we want, whenever we want.
So it's your classic snobs v. slob story. By the way, given that amazing restraint by the creators not to call this show the OB because they could have. But anyway, so we got John B. His friends are JJ. He's blonde. He's a kleptomaniac future tax cheat. So I guess he lives long enough to be an adult, which is good to know. Kiara. She's a rich hippie who's slumming it with John B. and his crew. Pope, who is super smart, they all assume bound for better things. Finally, John B. He lives in an old fish shack on the marsh, which I think we're supposed to think is shitty, but is actually this like super adorable, like rough hewn cabin that looks pretty big. His dad disappeared at sea 9 months ago and thus has been declared legally dead. But John B. refuses to sign papers to that effect until he sees a body. His mother left when John B. was 3. And officially, we learn his Uncle T is John B.'s legal guardian, but he's in Mississippi building houses. And while you're watching it, you're like, well, OK, doesn't matter. John B. is clearly 29, so he'll probably be fine. But then the next scene is him in high school. So it's like, OK. Yeah, he looks real old. Granted, he's out in the sun a lot because as we heard in that clip, he's got a bunch of jobs working on boats and stuff. But anyway, the guidance counselor is threatening him with foster care if he can't produce his Uncle T quickly, like the next day. But fortunately, a threatened home visit by DCS is going to be delayed by the arrival of Hurricane Agatha. And the day after said hurricane, John B. and the crew go out to see what it churned up in the marsh, and they hit what they think is a sandbar, but turns out to be a boat. And he swims down to see what they can find, comes up with a motel room key. We also see a body floating. The kids don't see that. Then we cut over to a rich person's house in figure eight. The dad of the house is good old Chip Esten from Nashville.
Oh, okay.
These are the Camerons. John B. works for them, too, on their yacht. His daughter is Sarah. Some guy named Scooter, who works for them in some capacity, unclear, is missing. And so, having found this key in the boat, the kids try to do the right thing and go to, like, a, you know, emergency Coast Guard detachment that's been set up and try and tell them about the boat. But the Coast Guard people are overwhelmed by dumb rich people and their unimportant problems. So the kids go to the motel room instead, go into the room. Figure out there's some, whoever was staying there left like the code to the room safe on a notepad conveniently. So they open it up and find a bunch of cash and a gun. And while they're in there, some crooked sheriffs also come into the room. They also go into the safe. The kids sneak out of the window and there's like conveniently a ledge right outside. So they are not discovered, but, you know, noted crooked sheriffs. Then that night there is a keg party, clip two.
All right, you can't understand the Outer Banks without understanding the Boneyard. It's kind of like a three-layer burrito.
What's up, homie? What's up, man?
Why not?
There's us and our friends, the working-class derelicts from the Cut.
Yeah. Hey, hey.
And then there are the kooks, the rich second homers. They're mostly from pouncy-ass boarding schools, just rich, justifying posers, our natural enemies. And then there are the Torons.
Do you want a beer?
Totally clueless, here for a week on vacation with their families.
Hey. You want a beer?
Chum for the sharks.
Got it. That's the kinds of people that there are. So
this guy's narration is the punchable faces of narration.
Yes.
Just hearing it, I want to. Like, I watched it with you, so. You
know, yeah.
He's a handsome boy whose face I would like to punch.
Mm-hmm.
But boy, that narration.
Mm-hmm.
Socko.
Yeah. Not interesting. So at this party, also, Sarah Cameron, Chip Esten's daughter, shows up. She's Kiara's ex-best friend. As we recall, Kiara is in the crew, rich hippie, slumming it with them. Sarah Cameron is the kook princess. So then the sheriff, who also found in the safe some photos in an envelope, he matches a photo from the motel room to a very old ship at like the Historical Society that was lost with tons of treasure. So noted. Back to the party. John B. gets into a fight with Sarah's boyfriend. Like all TV teens and movie teens sometimes, this shitty rich guy loves taunting John B., the apparent orphan, about his dead parents. Like, only on TV, I swear to God.
Yeah.
Like, why? Why is this a trope? Has this ever happened in real life? What?
Real Housewives of Potomac. They really go for the mom angle, too.
But she's not dead.
She's not dead, but dead to her.
Sure. Not really, if she's paying her rent. Anyway. So they get into a fight. Sarah's shitty rich boyfriend gets the jump on John B. and is, like, fully beating him, like, beating the shit out of him while literally no person around intervenes, of, like, the dozens and dozens of people are there, until finally, like, JJ appears out of the crowd and pulls the gun on the rich boyfriend, and then the crowd disperses, and, you know, the crew is going to try and keep a low profile with this gun that they took out of the motel room, but that's over now because now everyone knows they have it. Then we find out from John B. that his dad told him before his disappearance that he might have to disappear for a while, which is why John B. doesn't believe that he was actually lost at sea. And then the next day, another deputy that we haven't seen before comes by John B.'s place to say she'll keep DCS off his ass if he stays out of the marsh, but that just convinces the kids that there is something out there that's worth digging into. So John B. goes and borrows scuba equipment from the Camerons and dives down there to see what he can find. While he's down there, the crooked sheriffs show up to intimidate their friends, but they leave before he surfaces again. Two other toughs show up to chase them in their boat, which, like, in my notes, it's like, oh, a boat chase, not that dramatic. And then the tough guy starts shooting at them. It's like, all right, you win.
There's always a fjord.
Right. So then finally, the John B. shows his friends what he found, which, from the boat after diving down there, it's a compass, and they're all like, it's worthless. And then he's like, it's my dad's. Dun, dun, dun. And that's the episode. So this is definitely a situation where Kiara is only there so the guys can all talk a lot about how they all have crushes on her. And so we know they're straight, but obviously there's major homoerotic energy coming off of this thing, which is like,
they're just a beach and a volleyball away from a Top Gun scene.
Truly. It's a lot of, like, unbuttoned button downs and board shorts. Like, it's that kind of vibe, you know?
Uh-huh.
They're very golden. Like, you know, it did it work on me? Kind of. But based on Richard's description, I was expecting it to be more overtly horny, and it really is not. At least in the pilot, it's not.
The problem with the script is that all the teens, this could just work if they were adults too. There's nothing particularly teeny about their behavior, their wise narration. Like, any teen that tried to do something like that, I'd be like, and then I dropped your taco in the fryer. Like, there's they're not writing them as teens, right?
Because 26, seriously.
You can have, like, teens that are also above the fray or are a little bit wiser or more worldly and everything. But, like, there is so little teen about the teen drama in this pilot.
Yeah. I mean, the annoying part is that it starts out being like, our goal this summer is to have a good time all the time. So it's like, why did we then see them in school? That's A. But B, like, B is the lead guy, looks so old, I heard a complaint about that. But like, you know, in terms of the story, as Dave was saying, like, they could just be, you know, in their 20s or whatever, working on boats. And are teenagers interested in maritime salvage storylines? I don't know. I'm not. I guess teenagers were interested in it.
That's like the only thing I found interesting about it, that I was like, ooh, a dive. Raising the Titanic. I'm a grandpa.
The problem with maritime storylines is they're just, like, often rudderless.
Oh. Get out.
Oh, no. You can't ice me out because of my own campfire of comedy.
Wait, we're at a campfire now?
Anyway, that's Outer Banks. So thank you, Richard. I didn't mind looking at these very nicely tanned boys' chests. But other than that, I think I'm as Sarah was with Upstart Crow. I think I'm all set with this one.
All right, guys, that is it for another episode of Extra Hot Great. Sometimes you pick TV, and sometimes TV picks on you. That's a lesson Dave learned with his first episode of Real Housewives. Sarah answered the question, Upstart Crow, Series 3, Episode 2B, or not Series 3, Episode 2B. And Tara felt a little crabby after taking a trip to the Outer Banks. Next up on EEHG, it's the Oys of Summer, taking summery movies and turning them into TV shows. And then on EHG Prime, it's Palm Springs. Interesting. Remember,
we're listening.
I am David T. Cole, and on behalf of Tara Ariano,
stay out of the marsh,
Sarah D. Bunting,
it only remains to crowbar in the incomprehensible subplots.
Thanks for listening. We'll see you next time right here on Extra. Not great.
Slap your mama, okay? And your grandmama.